2012 was another record-breaking year at the movie box office, but did Hollywood deserve that success? Today on Central Standard Friday, join me, Russ Simmons, and the movie critics as we dish the dirt on the current cinematic fair and share our lists of the best and worst movies of 2012. What did you see in the theaters that topped your list? Was there a cinematic stinker you'd advise our listeners to avoid? Again, join me and the movie critics as we look back at the cream of the crop, as well as the bottom of the Hollywood well, for the year 2012. That's coming up right after this hour's NPR News. Good morning, Kansas City, and welcome to Central Standard Friday. I'm Russ Simmons, sitting here in the host's chair, and that means it's movie day here on KCUR. And so we're going to be talking about some movies that have come up over the last month or so in Kansas City area theaters. We're also going to be talking about the best and worst movies of 2012 as we take a look back on the cinematic year. And this morning I'm joined by...
This is Loie Lockerbie. I freelance for the Kansas City Star and KCActive.com and have a blog at SuchACritic.com.
And I'm Tom Poe. I teach film history, theory, and criticism at UMKC.
And again, I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM. And as I said before, we're going to be looking back at 2012. We're going to be sharing our top five films and our worst five films, not only the critics that are around the table here today, but we'll be sharing those lists from our other critics that join us regularly here on Central Standard Friday. But I want to know, what do you think is the best film of the year? What made it so remarkable? Are there any common threads that you noticed in this year's movies? Did the best films of the year have a common thread? And what's a movie that you would say, hey, you got to avoid this one at all costs. This movie was a real turkey. What are the best and worst of 2012? We want you to give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also send us a note at centralstandard@kcur.org, or you can also tweet us at KCURCST. We want to hear back from you on the best and worst films of 2012. Well, we're going to jump in first with the biggest box office hit currently, and that is the latest in the Lord of the Rings installments, the Tolkien, and I'm going to defer to our self-professed Tolkien nerd, Loie Lockerbie, to start us off on The Hobbit.
Well, you know, I almost feel like I should recuse myself because Peter Jackson's first Lord of the Rings film made me a Tolkien nerd. I had only read The Hobbit and finished it the night before I saw Fellowship of the Ring.
Wow.
And from that point, I just dove right into Middle Earth. I mean, it made me a fan. So, you know, whatever flaws The Hobbit movie has, I'm just glad to be back home, you know? This is, of course, the first of three installments based on a relatively short children's book that Tolkien wrote several years before Lord of the Rings. What they do is they take material from other sources, like the appendices and some of the other Tolkien writings, and blend them in. So not only are we following the journey of Bilbo Baggins as he helps a group of dwarves reclaim their kingdom and finds a shiny little ring while he's at it, but we're also seeing things that in Tolkien's mythology were happening at the same time and that lead up to events in Lord of the Rings. I saw this at the fancy new 48 frames per second 3D format, and that part works really well in action scenes and low light scenes because it takes away that blurry effect and that too dark effect that you get with a lot, especially 3D movies. It doesn't work as well in the brightly lit and more static scenes. It takes on that kind of airless video quality that people are complaining about. And I think it may just be a matter of the technology needs to be tweaked a little bit. But I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, these higher frame rates become more the standard. That would be okay, you know. I don't really object to it. I think they do need to kind of work on the technology a little. But I'm curious to see it at a regular frame rate just because it is a little bit distracting. And it's hard to get into the movie completely when you're thinking about, okay, that looks pretty good here. Man, I kind of wish they'd shot this one at 24, you know. It is very long. They don't leave out anything because in a book this short, you really don't need to. I'm not a big fan of some of Jackson's more juvenile humor and some of those things, but it's still – it's such a fun movie. It's such an adventure, and it really does feel like coming home. You're going back to Middle Earth, and if you love Jackson's other movies, this is just – it's another chance to visit. And I enjoyed it very much. I think Martin Freeman, who plays the young Bilbo Baggins, is a terrific choice. And, of course, you've got Ian McKellen back as Gandalf. So great, great fun. And whatever flaws it has, I really can't hold it against it. So I'm still going to give it I'll give it a 3.5 just to be more of a critic. But, honestly, I'm going to see it again a couple more times. So.
That's 3.5 out of 5 stars for The Hobbit and Unexpected Journey. Tom?
Well, I'm not the Tolkien maniac that my friend Loie is. To prove that, when I was in graduate school, I had roommates who, in fact, were fanatics. And all they talked about was Lord of the Rings day and night just to survive because I could not make it through all of those Lord of the Rings books. I read The Hobbit because I thought it was Tolkien light. And in many ways, what I think is sort of surprising is that it's what Peter Jackson is sort of left with to continue sort of taking Loie to Middle Earth. So he's going to, in fact, start off again this big trilogy. But it's from a fairly slight sort of material. And this first film seems to be setting everything up for everything which is going to come. And that gets, I think, sort of bogs the film down. It may improve as things go along.
It's hard to judge the first part.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think my one sort of complaint, because I enjoyed the movie, so I'm going to be kind and give it lots of stars. But because of the new technology that Peter Jackson has to play with, particularly with the 3D and all of that, he's like a little boy with a toy where he can just do all these things. And so because he can do them, he feels compelled to do them, where I think that this is where more ultimately comes to be less. There's whole sequences where two mountains fight each other that sort of visually, sort of spectacular, but I thought really lame dramatically. But Gollum shows back up, and then I'm totally happy. With being called precious. So I think that it's a fine film. It certainly, to me, is not setting up to give us the thrill of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, but we'll wait and see. So I'm going to give it, you give it 3.5,
sure.
I can go with that.
Okay.
Well, let's make it 3.5 all the way around. I'll give it the same rating. You know, it's big, it's bloated, it doesn't know when to stop, yes, all of those things, except it also is visually spectacular. I did have to admit that I saw it only in the 24 frames per second 3D. I didn't see the 48, but I am anxious to check that out just to see what the difference might be. But it's the sort of thing that Peter Jackson, you know, has down pat now. So the bottom line is, if you like the Lord of the Rings movies, you're going to like The Hobbit as well. So I'll give it 3.5, and that's for The Hobbit rated PG-13. And speaking of big and bloated and doesn't know when to stop, let's go ahead and talk about Les Miserables, which is a major movie musical. Tom, you want to start us off on that one?
I'll be happy to start us off on Les Miserables. Because I'm a musical theater sort of geek, the way that Loie is a Tolkien aficionado. And so anyone that sort of shares that with me knows that Les Mis for nearly 30 years has been, in fact, this landmark musical that people just adore or they just hate. And that probably goes down to whether, in fact, you really love the sort of pop operas, lowbrow operas that Cameron Mackintosh, the producer of shows like Phantom of the Opera, ends up loving, and shows like Les Mis, Miss Saigon, or you're a fan of Stephen Sondheim's types of sophisticated musicals. I'm in the Sondheim camp, so I've never been a great fan of Les Mis. But, you know, I immensely enjoyed this film, so I'm going to give it high praise. I don't think that Tom Hooper, in fact, directs it with any sort of great distinction, but the performances are so terrific that when it is good, it just hits magnificent heights, particularly with Anne Hathaway, with Hugh Jackman. And I think Eddie Redmayne just is fantastic, and what a great voice. My one suggestion to Hollywood, though, is that this is the type of film that back in the 1960s would have been called a roadshow attraction, and we would have had a nice, fat intermission right between one and two, and that this film desperately needs that type of treatment because the structure of the musical is that it needs a break after the spectacular One Day More montage sequence, which is really well done. And then you need a break to come back to the next really big number. You can hear the people sing. Here they are, just crashed in together without, in fact, that time to go and breathe and go, oh, isn't this great? Isn't this great? And buy your hardcover program book. But other than that, I think that it is the best job that you can make of something which is overly bloated, pretentious, all those negatives that I could add. But, in fact, then it wouldn't be Les Mis.
True. And how many out of 5 stars?
So I'm going to go ahead and give it 4 stars.
Louis?
Yeah, I'd be more in the 3.5 camp and slightly the opposite response as far as Tom Hooper's concerned, because I think he did a better job directing this than he actually did The King's Speech, for which he won the Oscar. Part of that is because it's so hard to make a movie of a big bloated musical that isn't just completely inert. And this thing moves. He gives it more of a sort of gritty historical feel and gets very naturalistic performances out of the actors, which to me is appealing because the thing I hate about musicals is how bloated and artificial and, you know, inert they are. This thing felt like a movie to me, not like a filmed play of something I would not voluntarily watch in the first place. So even though I'm not a fan of the music necessarily, and I do find it a bit overmuch, I enjoyed it and was shocked at how much I enjoyed it because I was kind of dreading watching it. But the performances are terrific. I like the atmosphere. And I think he does a good job of just keeping the story going and making it feel cinematic, which is very, very hard to do in a situation like this.
You know, I need to add one other thing. Because one of the great accomplishments of this film, and it's a great triumph of Anne Hathaway, there's a real problem with Les Mis, and that is Susan Boyle. Her I Dreamed a Dream has become such an international anthem of triumph over humiliation that then Anne Hathaway has to go back and, in fact, totally sort of erase Susan Boyle from our mind.
Yeah.
Her sequence is breathtakingly dramatic and just great.
And I think she's a lock for the Best Supporting Actress Oscar simply for that song. You know, in full disclosure, I sat and I watched this with my wife, and we went through a box of Kleenex between the two of us. I was surprised at how moving it was to me. I saw the Broadway production. I thought it was very good, and then I thought that Tom Hooper did an exceptional job in translating it to the big screen. The only weak link, as far as I was concerned, was Russell Crowe, who doesn't always hit the right notes, and I don't mean that just musically. He just wasn't quite right as Javert, I felt. But this is a movie about grace versus the law, and it really does make its point about how an individual can make a difference in how if you stick to what you believe is true. You know, it's reinforcing all of those classic moral teachings that we got from Sunday school. So if that touches you in some way, that you probably will really relate to this movie the way I did. So I'm going to give it a 4.5. So I think between the three of us, we can average it out to a 4 out of 5 stars for Les Miserables. I think it's actually one of the strongest movies of the year. You're listening to Central Standard Friday. It's Movie Day here. We're talking about the best and worst movies of 2012. And we'd like to get your feedback. What did you think was the best film? What did you think was the worst film? What should we avoid? So you can join us by calling 816-235-2888 or send us a note at centralstandard@kcur.org. Also, you can tweet us if you want at KCURCST. I want to make sure that we get as many of these contemporary films in before we talk about our best and worst lists. So let's go ahead and move it and talk about another film that opened on Christmas Day, Django Unchained, rated R. This is Quentin Tarantino's latest opus, a kind of an homage to spaghetti westerns, as well as the blaxploitation films of the 1960s. And if you don't have an affection for that kind of entertainment, the grindhouse kind of cinema, this will not be your cup of tea. It's a very violent movie. It is getting a lot of controversy over the fact that the N-word is used over 150 times. However, the NAACP, I guess, has nominated it for an Image Award anyway. So I guess that, you know, at least in the minds of some people, it puts that controversy to rest. Although I do understand that Spike Lee is refusing to see it for that very reason. But just the same, I think we need to keep our criticisms to films we have seen, so it's not very helpful. This movie is a guilty pleasure. It's long. It's very over, you know, it's operatic in a lot of ways, but it's also wildly entertaining. Even though it's horrifically graphic in its violence, it's a revenge fantasy. Jamie Foxx plays a freed slave who travels around with Christoph Waltz, who's a German bounty hunter, and they're in the Deep South, and Django is trying to free his wife, who's a slave of a plantation owner, played with eye-rolling and mustache-twirling bravado by Leonardo DiCaprio. It's over the top. It's trademark Quentin Tarantino, and I'm going to give it 3.5.
I never feel guilty about loving any Quentin Tarantino movie. This is a man who so clearly loves movies and loves making movies, and it just leaps off the screen. And it's here the same thing. Now, I will say that I think it goes on about half an hour too long. It needed a little judicious editing. But as a story, it's terrific. I think he's doing here a little bit similar to what he did in Inglourious Basterds, which is taking history and giving the underdogs a chance to get theirs back. He doesn't change history in Django Unchained to quite the same extent. But it's still that same idea of, you know, give the people who've been oppressed and brutalized a sort of fantasy way of getting their revenge. And the whole N-word thing is ridiculous. Do you really think they called them African Americans in 1857? No. I mean, that was the commonly used word up until pretty recently. So, you know, that's hardly an issue. And the violence, of course, you know, we're talking about slavery. We're talking about, you know, the years leading up to the Civil War, of course it's violent. And it's probably more graphic and realistic in its portrayal of the horrors of slavery than most movies have been. I mean, it's pretty stare you right in the face. It's got great performances. Jamie Foxx makes a very, very good sort of taciturn Western hero. Christoph Waltz is just a delight, as always. DiCaprio gets to play a villain, and he has a great time. And Samuel L. Jackson turns up in a role that it actually took me about 10 minutes to realize that's who it was. It's a fascinating role, and he's just great. He steals every scene he's in, as usual. Kerry Washington's also very good as Django's wife, even though she doesn't have a lot of dialogue. You know, it's a very interesting performance. So, I'm going to give it a 4.
Tom?
You know, this is one of Tarantino's very best films, and that's saying a great deal, given how many really terrific films he's made. I think the first hour and a half of this film is as good as filmmaking gets. I thought it was just spectacularly great through that first half. There's a sequence with the Ku Klux Klan showing up.
Very funny.
Oh, yeah. Is really memorable. And there's images of Christopher Waltz is playing a dentist, and he goes from town to town with this tooth on a spring that is just gloriously visual. As a spaghetti Western, which is one of the things that genres that it is sort of smashing up with, I think that it's overcooked spaghetti in that it goes on probably 30 minutes, maybe 20 minutes too long. And it isn't just that it needs editing all the way through. I think that it needed to end at the operatic high point of sort of one of the major bloodbaths, because that's where I think your adrenaline is really pumping. And then it goes back to sort of more narrative that I think sort of spoils the emotional impact of the film. But otherwise, it's really terrific. It is obscene, violent, gory, sort of in regards to violence, almost pornographically so, but so is the greatest film that has ever dealt with slavery, and that is the cheap exploitation 70s film Mandingo. And I teach that film in class, and I acknowledge it is just a pornographic film. But, you know, it's the only film that really gets close to slavery as really pornographic.
Until now.
It gets to a truth until yeah. now. So I think that this film is a good updating of that truth that Mandingo shows, that there's that whole period of American history is violent, it's gory, it's obscene, and it's pornographic.
So how many stars out of five?
I'm going to give it 4 stars.
So we'll average that out to 4 stars for Django Unchained, which earns that R rating. We've gotten some feedback from some people here regarding the best films of 2012. And Alicia tweets that her favorites of 2012 are Moonrise Kingdom, Celeste and Jesse Forever, Silver Linings Playbook, and Django Unchained, the one we just talked about. I think you're going to hear those some of those same titles showing up again on our lists when we share them after the bottom of the hour. And also, Jake on Facebook writes, Beasts of the Southern Wild was by far my favorite film
Amen.
This year. That's a very good film. It's also going to be showing up on some yeah. of our lists, as we'll be talking about very shortly. As I said before, we will be talking about the best and worst films of the year and sharing those coming up very shortly after the end of the hour. But before we take a break, I wanted to talk about a Kansas City boy made good, Paul Rudd, starring in the comedy This Is 40.
This Is 40 is Judd Apatow's latest overly long comedy. It's over 2 hours. Doesn't have much of a plot. It's characters who were supporting characters in Knocked Up, the married couple played by Paul Rudd and Leslie Mann. And it basically is their midlife crisis story. It's a series of sort of vignettes strung together about them dealing with the sort of stagnation in their marriage and financial problems and issues with their kids and parents and so on. It's very funny most of the time. It's very insightful most of the time. It reminded me a little of Hope Springs in that I have virtually nothing in common with these people, and yet I completely sympathized and identified with them. But it is too long. It needs a good half hour cut out of it. It just tends to kind of drag on, and everybody just improvises to death. So Apatow's a very good writer, but I think as a director, he needs maybe somebody else to take over that part of it. So I'll give it go ahead and give it a 3.
Tom?
Well, Judd Apatow is sort of the master of male masochism. And in fact, here we spend all this time, and it's much too much time, with probably some of the most unpleasant, obnoxious people that you can imagine. So that made me not find it all that funny. But, you know, as I thought back about the film, I realized I needed to recalibrate it and reconsider that maybe if I don't watch it as a comedy, but in fact as an American tragedy, that it probably has some lasting sort of strength to the film. This is like Death of a Salesman with potty humor. So I'm going to go ahead and maybe give it 3 stars, just because I think the performances are really strong and there's something probably important about Judd Apatow's films.
You know, Robert Smigel is a supporting character in this film, and it plays one of Paul Rudd's friends. And he's also, in real life, also the voice of Triumph, the insult comic dog. And there's a very funny video that's been posted on A Funny or Die, the website, that has Triumph, the insult comic dog, interviewing the cast members and Judd Apatow from This Is 40. And there's a moment in it where Triumph says to Judd Apatow, he said, "This is 40 minutes too long." And that pretty much sums it up, because it is too long. And he's, for whatever reason, Judd Apatow does not know how to edit a film, or refuses for whatever reason to edit out all of the improv that his cast members are doing. And that really hurts the pace of the film and holds it back the same way it has held back some of his other product. That said, I agree with you that the cast is very attractive. Paul Rudd, he's always does a great job. Leslie Mann, and there's some good supporting performances as well. It is, as you said, Tom, potty mouth, and I think that's pretty much true. So I'm going to give it 3, and we'll average it out to 3 for This Is 40, rated R. Once again, we're talking about the best and worst films of 2012. Join in on the conversation by giving us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also send us a note at centralstandard@kcur.org or tweet us at KCURCST. We'll be back with more right after the break. And welcome back to Central Standard Friday. It's Movie Day. I'm Russ Simmons, and I'm joined by my fellow movie critics Lloyd Lockerbie and Tom Poe here on the panel. We're going to be talking about the best and worst films of 2012, as well as covering some of the other current releases, letting you know what's up to date in the movie world. Wanted to share somebody who contacted us earlier via phone at 816-235-2888, and that's Dave. And Dave said that Lincoln was his favorite film of the year, and I think that his point was that it resonates still because of the machinations, the political back room wrangling that went on to try to get the 13th Amendment passed during Lincoln's day.
Very
that
true.
That sort of thing is still going on in Washington today. So it does have a contemporary resonance. So thank you, Dave, for contacting us. Did you have a favorite film? As I said, give us a call. Let us know what the best film of 2012 was. What was the worst film? Make sure that you let us know what to avoid. So give us a call or send us a note. I wanted to get a few announcements out of the way, some things happening around town that you may be interested in. Glee star Chris Colfer will have a screening of a film called Struck by Lightning at the Tivoli, and it's going to be an interactive Q&A screening. So it'll be in several different cities, and so audience members will be able to interact and have a Q&A with Chris Colfer. The movie is called Struck by Lightning. It's a one-night-only thing. It's Sunday, January 6th at 7 p.m. at the Tivoli. And if you want more information, you can find that out at kcur.org. Also, the Cinemark presents its classic film series once again, fully restored Hollywood classic series. It continues on the big screen at select Cinemark theaters during the months of January and February of 2013. And the next one up is Wednesday, January 9th. It's Rocky. And upcoming titles include The Sound of Music, To Catch a Thief, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and Saturday Night Fever, fully restored and up on the big screen where they belong. You can find out more information at kcur.org. And also, our colleague, Bob Butler, Robert Butler, formerly the Kansas City Star and now with the Kansas City Public Library, is continuing his Movies That Matter series. And this Sunday, January 6th, at 1:30 p.m. at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library, will be the silent film classic Joan of Arc. It's one of 20 films essential to cinematic literacy. So if you think you're film literate, you can find out, and you will be if you see all of the films in this series. And once again, you can find out more information at kcur.org. We have a call from Jim who wants to join in on the conversation. Jim and Lee Summit, and he thinks Lincoln, on the other hand, was bad. Tell us about it, Jim.
It was a big waste of time and a waste of the greatest actors of our time. It didn't go anywhere. Nothing happened. I had to wait in line and go through a lot to see it, and it was just like a fallen souffle that was delicious for the acting, but was a big mess.
You know, it's interesting you should say that, because I think you had a very similar reaction to my wife, because when we were watching it, I was riveted. I thought the movie was very, very interesting, and as we were walking out, she said, that was really dull.
It was very dull, and I don't know your wife. I'm sure I'd have a great reaction to her.
Look out, Russ.
I totally agree with her.
Thank you so much, Jim. Appreciate your call.
Thank you. Bye.
I think we should just jump right in with both feet right now and start talking about our best and worst films. So, Lloyd, if you'd be kind enough, tell us, maybe let's do it dramatically and do it in reverse order. Start with your fifth and work up to your best film of 2012.
Well, ranking these was hard, and there's a lot more that I liked. It was a very good year. But number five, I would say The Master with Philip Seymour Hoffman. Four, Argo, which is wonderful. 3, Beasts of the Southern Wild, which one of our listeners commented on. Number 2, Life of Pi, which is absolutely enchanting. And number 1 is Zero Dark Thirty, which opens here in a couple of weeks. And yes, you should see it.
And if there are 5 films we should avoid, Loie, what would they be? Started with 5 and built up to the worst film of the year.
The Pirates Band of Misfits, which is one of the lamer animated films for a while. Act of Valor. John Carter. What a mess. Alex Cross. And my number one worst, because I still don't know what this movie was, The Odd Life of Timothy Green.
Mm.
Talk about odd. Yeah, a little bit.
It does live up to its title, doesn't it? Okay, let's bring in Alonso into the conversation in Parkville. Hi, welcome aboard.
Hi.
Is it Alfonso?
Alfonso, yes.
Great. You wanted to talk about Atlas Shrugged, right?
Yes, sir. Part 2.
Tell us about the film.
Well, the film is based on Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. And although it's very difficult to transport a book of that magnitude into a movie, and they also changed characters from part 1 to part 2, I thought it was an excellent movie. It got the general idea of her novel and her philosophy, and I thought it was a fantastic book. It hasn't been mentioned.
I appreciate you bringing that to our attention. You know, we did see Atlas Shrugged Part 1, but the distributors of that film, it's a self-distributed film, so it doesn't go through the Hollywood system. So it's one that they did not have any advanced screenings for the critics. So I had to go out and seek it out and see it, and did. However, with Atlas Shrugged Part 2, once again, it was not screened for the critics, so I went to see it, but it was already gone. So it had only lasted a very short time in the theaters.
Very short time, yes, sir.
Well, thanks for bringing that to our attention, Alfonso. Appreciate it.
Now, the other question I have, I heard about Cloud Atlas, about this famous novel that goes through time.
Yes.
They haven't mentioned that much. I haven't had a chance to see it.
Loie?
I liked it a lot. It doesn't always work, but I just love how ambitious it is, and it's really a masterwork of editing and adaptation. So I recommend it, although it's not an easy film.
I know that it's showing up on both best and worst lists this year. So it's one of those that I thought it was brilliantly edited. If I would give it a thumbs up on any one thing, that would be it, because it does build to a satisfying climax thanks to some really, really skillful editing. Tom, Cloud Atlas?
I think it's totally admirable, but I didn't find it particularly enjoyable. I kept kind of getting lost. I will admit that may be that I'm not worthy of, in fact, this great film, but I found it slow going.
It's not easy, but I thought it was worth it.
Thanks for the call, Alfonso.
Thank you.
We're now joined by Jesse from Leavenworth, who wants to talk about Lincoln. Hi, Jesse.
Hi. I want to tell you, I'm a reconstructed Southerner originally from Vicksburg, Mississippi, which Lincoln famously had taken during the Civil War. Lincoln was the best movie I've ever seen. It was truly moving. I was no fan of Lincoln until I saw that movie, and after I saw that movie, I thought, you idiot, how could you not have thought he was the greatest president we've ever had?
You know, it's interesting that one of the criticisms that Lincoln has been getting is for the quote-unquote stilted dialogue, but most of that dialogue was direct quotes from Lincoln himself, so maybe Lincoln spoke in a stilted way.
I don't. Yes, who knows? I wasn't alive then.
Good point. You
know, almost alive then, but anyway, I just sat in my seat. I couldn't move the whole entire movie, and that was a long movie.
Yes, yeah. It was. Yeah. Thank you so much, Jesse. Appreciate your feedback.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
Bye bye.
Kim writes us on Twitter. She says, The Sessions was my absolute favorite this year. So wonderful. And it was really fun watching it at the Glenwood Theater. And, of course, The Sessions is about a man who plays by John Hawkes, who is a quadriplegic, I believe, who is attempting to have sex for the first time in his life at age 38, I believe it is, something like that. And Helen Hunt plays a sex surrogate. And
It is a good movie. The performances are incredible.
I think we're going to see a lot of awards consideration for that one coming up. Also, Allison added the thread that she thought The Intouchables was her favorite film of the year. And The Intouchables, of course, is a French film about a paraplegic who is attended to, a wealthy man who's attended to by a young African descendant who is in France, and it's a French language film. It's very touching in how these two interact and the bond that's created between those two. So The Untouchables is a very good film. I think it's a lock for an Academy Award nomination for Best Foreign Film. I don't know if it will win, but it's a very good film. So I think it's a good addition to the lists. Tom, if you'd be kind enough, go ahead and share your top films of the year with us, starting with number five.
Well, my number five, in fact, is Lincoln, which I find a totally engrossing, admirable film. Number four is The Master, which I think is a masterclass in acting. Number three is Les Miserables, because, like with Russ, I cried. Number two is Beast of the Southern Wild, which I think is a totally unique movie. With the character Hush Puppy being one that one will always remember.
Oh, yeah.
Number one, I'm absolutely certain of my number one choice. The others, you can argue with me. But I found The Life of Pi to be just absolutely magnificent. And I think that it is, of all of my list, the film that whoever is teaching film theory and history in 25 years from now is most likely to, in fact, still be studying and showing. I think its themes become deeper the longer that I thought about them. Ang Lee's use of 3D is magnificent. Everything about, I think, The Life of Pi is totally the best of magic realism. So it's clearly my number one.
Yep.
And what should we avoid at the video store, Tom? What are your worst films of 2012?
Well, Lloyd mentioned one of them, so I gave dishonorable mention to The Odd Life of Timothy Green because it was so sickeningly sweet, I feared I gained 10 pounds watching it. But my five worst, I'll start with five is Battleship because it is just a board game made as a bloated movie. Four and three are both remakes, and I put them down to raise the question about why were these films remade. Total Recall comes in as the remake, which hit number four, because that was a good movie, so why remake it as a bad movie? But even worse, at number three, is Red Dawn, because that was a bad movie that they remade as an even worse movie. Number two, I'm with Lloyd on this one, John Carter, where, in fact, the star's abs does most of the acting. But number one clearly has to be That's My Boy. It's just despicable. And it gets laughs out of subject matter that is so queasy. The whole thing is just dreadful.
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm going to go ahead and share some of the lists of our colleagues who sometimes join us here on the panel. Marie Asner shared her top five with us, and at number five, she has A Royal Affair, which is the Danish language film. And at number four, Zero Dark Thirty, Catherine Bigelow's film about the search for Osama bin Laden. At number three, The Hobbit, which we discussed earlier. Number two, Les Miserables, and her number one film of the year, well, Jesse will like to know that Marie also picked Lincoln as her top film of the year. And here's her bottom five. Now, this is kind of interesting because Marie has on the bottom five some of the ones that some of the rest of us have on our top five. But at number five, she has The Impossible, which is a film that we'll be talking about very shortly. Number four, Taken 2. Number three, Silver Linings Playbook. That was number four was Taken 2. Number three, Silver Linings Playbook. Number two, Life of Pi, Tom, if you can believe that. And
what?
Number one, her worst film of 2012 was Jack and Diane, which was pretty abysmal. It was a story about two teenage lesbians, one of which could be a werewolf. And it's worse than it sounds.
Oh, dear.
Our colleague John Tibbetts also shared his top and bottom five. And John Tibbetts' number five film was Silent House, which is an interesting choice. It's a quirky horror film with Elizabeth Wilson, or Elizabeth, what's her name? Elizabeth Olsen. Number four, Moonrise Kingdom, the Wes Anderson comedy. At number three, A Royal Affair, the one we just mentioned that was also on Marie's list. Beasts of the Southern Wild came in at number two for John Tibbetts. And his number one film, Tom, you'll be glad to know, was also Life of Pi. And here's the movies he says to avoid. At number 5, Sinister, another horror film, that one with Ethan Hawke. Number 4, Anna Karenina, the most recent adaptation. Number 3, 21 Jump Street, the comic remake of the old TV show. At number 2, The Campaign, the Will Ferrell election comedy. And at number 1, the worst film of the year, according to John Tibbetts, Hope Springs, which was a film about sexagenarians and their marital problems with two of our best actors. It's Tommy Lee Jones and Meryl Streep. But that was his worst film of the year. Okay, here it is, my list. My top 5 for the year. At number 5, Searching for Sugar Man, which was a wonderful documentary about an interesting rock performer from the 1970s who's disappeared, and it became a real-life mystery, and truth was stranger than fiction in this particular setting. At number 4, The Master, one we've talked about earlier. At number 3, Zero Dark Thirty, the Catherine Bigelow film about Osama bin Laden. At number 2, Les Miserables, which we just talked about. And at number 1, I'm agreeing with Tom and with John, Life of Pi, the top film of the year. Now, here's the ones to avoid. At number 5, The 5-Year Engagement, which was a comedy that felt like it lasted 5 years. American Reunion, the latest in the American Pie franchise, which, you know, reunites us with people we don't want to have anything to do with. Number 3, The Watch, the Ben Stiller comedy, which was unwatchable. At number 2, Jack and Diane, which was topping Marie's list, the story about the teenage werewolf lesbians. And at number 2, That's My Boy. I'm agreeing with you, Tom. That was the worst film of the year. Adam Sandler and all of the people involved in that movie should know better. I mean, there's no way they need the movie money this badly to be in something this awful. I mean, this is the sort of movie that sometimes actors will do when their careers are sagging and they really need the dough, but there's no excuse because this movie was really, really horrible. I want to also share Eric Moline's list. Eric is a critic that joins us from time to time here on the show. At number 5 on his best list, Silver Linings Playbook. At number 4, Killer Joe, which is an interesting film, rated NC-17, a kind of a trailer trash noir film with Matthew McConaughey. At number 3, Life of Pi. Number 2, The Master. And at number 1, Eric's film is Amour, which is a French film, is really a heartbreaking movie about an elderly man who cares for his wife who has suffered from a stroke. It's really a heart-wrenching film. His bottom 5, the ones to avoid. At number 5, Wrath of the Titans. At number 4, Ted, which is the talking teddy bear raunch fest. At number 3, Project X, which is a one of those found footage type movies about a raunchy party. At number 2, get this on Eric's list, Les Miserables. If it doesn't work for you, it doesn't work for you. That's all there is to it. And at number 1, This Means War. This is a spy romantic comedy where Reese Witherspoon is the object of affection of two warring spies against one another. I think most of us have tried to forget that film, but anyway, it tops Eric's list as the worst film of the year. Lauren tweeted us, "I love Ted. It was hilarious. But even though I'm 20, Wreck-It Ralph was the best family movie of 2012.
It was a lot of fun.
Wreck-It Ralph, of course, was the film that was a animated offering from, was that Disney or was it actually Pixar? It was Disney
was
Pixar or Pixar Disney?
Hang on.
It was Disney,
was
but
it?
I'm not sure.
Well,
yeah.
They're the same now, aren't they?
They are the same, however, Disney has a separate animation arm.
Oh,
so
I can't keep track.
But we know the film anyway, and we agree. We all thought it was good as well. According to IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, That's My Boy had a budget of $70 million and only made $36.9 million, so it was a money flop as well. Thanks for that, Matthew, our intrepid producer, providing us with that information. So it's kind of
proof of the existence of a god?
Maybe so.
Russ, I've got a question.
Sure.
I wonder, historically, how many Adam Sandler movies have come in number one on the worst list over the past years?
Could be many.
To review them anymore. I told my editors I won't do it again.
Once again, you're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And let us know what your favorite film of the year was or what your worst film of the year was so that we can avoid it. Let's move ahead and talk about another film that opened up on Christmas Day. It's a family comedy called Parental Guidance. Tom?
This won't take very long.
Cool.
This stars Billy Crystal and the divine Miss M, Bette Midler, as crotchety old-school grandparents who have to spend a week taking care of their grandchildren who have been raised by terribly progressive parents. So it's going to be a clash of parenting styles. In fact, this is really funny if what you find as sort of a height of hilarity, Billy Crystal getting hit in the groin with a baseball bat and then throwing up on the head of a kid.
Yeah.
So that tells you all I probably need to say about how lame this comedy is. However, the saving grace is that Bette Midler is Bette Midler, and I immensely enjoyed every moment that she was on screen so I could get through the otherwise sort of totally lame screenplay.
And how many stars would you give it?
Oh, I'll give it 2.5.
I'll give it 1.5, so we'll average that out to 2. I
love
Billy Crystal.
Billy, what happened to
you? I love Billy. I love Bette, but this movie was not good. Let's talk quickly with Brian from Kansas City, who wants to talk about the best worst movie, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Yeah, I would say this movie is one of those where you're not sure if you should take it seriously or not. It's an entertaining movie as long as you don't take it seriously.
I couldn't agree with you more. It is a kind of a guilty pleasure, isn't it?
Definitely.
Yeah, it's it's interesting that it would come out the same year as Spielberg, so we can do a compare and contrast.
Yeah, that's I love that.
Thanks a lot, Brian. Appreciate your call.
All right, thank you.
Let's also quickly talk about a movie that opens today. It's because it made the list. It's The Impossible, rated PG-13. Loi?
Yeah, this is based on a true story about a Spanish couple and their three children who survived the Indian Ocean tsunami in 2004. They've been turned into a British couple so they could have more famous actors, in this case Ewan McGregor and Naomi Watts. It is a absolutely harrowing film. Especially the moments after the tsunami hits and the chaos and death. And it's absolutely the most tense thing I've seen in years. It does get a little bit of the kind of swelling score, you know, a little sort of sentimental as it goes along, which isn't really necessary because this is such a powerful, true story. But the performances are absolutely first rate. There's a kid named Tom Holland who plays the oldest son who just walks off with this thing. And just to give you a sense of what it was like and how chaotic it was and how terrifying it was and the choices people had to make, that part of it is really quite extraordinary. So I'll give it 3.5.
And Tom?
You know, while I was watching The Impossible, I was totally taken in and loving it. Oh. I think that the acting, particularly by Naomi Watts, but the young boy, Tom Holland, that's as good of a child acting as I can remember on a screen. It's that good. And it's so tautly directed, and the scenes of the tsunami hitting are so spectacular, and the mother and boys fight for survival, and all the way through the chaotic hospital scene where the young boy really becomes a man, all of that was just thrilling. Oh. And then I left the theater, and I suddenly got really, really angry and aggravated because I realized for all of this great cinematic experience, the script really is maudlin, dramatic, corny. And I think the end gets to be almost unethical. This was a Spanish family, but apparently I think that they may have been too dark-complected because we want to identify these beautiful white people. And there seems to be some Thai native sort of in the background. But then I started getting kind of incensed. And I don't want to give anything too much away, but when this very wealthy family ends up their insurance company arriving on the scene, I thought, oh, this is terrible.
Yeah, the only natives we see are these sort of quasi-angelic figures whose only reason to exist is to help the rich white people.
Exactly. They just stop everything.
I understand, you know, making a movie with well-known actors who will bring in box office. I get that. I even get why they didn't make him a Spanish family, because aside from Javier Bardem and Penelope Cruz, who are you going to bring in? And, you know, they're not big box office draws. But, yeah, the idea that, you know, everything should be just totally focused on this privileged family and all these other people are dying all around them. Yeah, the way that was handled was not great.
It starts out with a very compelling and spectacular tsunami sequence. However, it then, to my way of thinking, becomes a real slog, both for the characters and for the audience. So I'm only going to be able to give it a 3. So we're average it out to a 3 for The Impossible, rated PG-13. Let's quickly also talk about another movie that's getting some awards buzz for acting, Hyde Park on Hudson. Tom, you saw that, right?
I did see it. It is getting a lot of awards buzz. I have no idea why. Bill Murray plays FDR, so this seems to be the year of presidential films, but no one will confuse this with Lincoln, that's for sure. Bill Murray, I think, does do a reasonably good job, and he kind of physically kind of convinces you that he is FDR, but I don't know why they made this film. It is a few days in the life of FDR. He's having a tawdry affair with a distant cousin played by Laura Linney, who voiceovers so much on this film that it drives you nuts. Then the King and Queen of England show up, and he teaches them how to eat a hot dog, and that seems to be the plot of this film.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give it 2 stars.
I'll give it 2 as well. I liked Bill Murray, but I felt the film was kind of dull, and that's Hyde Park on the Hudson, rated R. We wanted to get Brian in, calling from Lenexa. He wants to talk about Intouchables. Hi, Brian. Byron, excuse me. Byron in Lenexa? Did we lose him? Oh, sorry about that. Well, Byron did want to talk about The Intouchables, who he thought was the best movie of all time.
Whoa.
So this is a movie that really had an effect on him. It's a very touching, very interesting movie. Let's go ahead and touch also on another film that opened back a couple of weeks ago, a action film called Jack Reacher. Tom?
I didn't see that.
Oh, sorry. Jack Reacher is a film with Tom Cruise.
That's why I didn't see that.
Oh, no.
It's an action film based on a series of popular novels, but this is the part that bothered me, is that the character is a 250-pound, 6'3", ex-military guy, and he's played by Tom Cruise, and that should probably tell you all you need to know. So I'm going to give Jack Reacher a 2.5. Thank you for joining us on Central Standard Friday. We're going to be back here in about a month to talk about some more movies that will have come up between now and then. On Monday, we find ways to turn emotional crises into opportunities for personal growth with Dr. Bruce Leese. And our show today was produced by Matthew Long Middleton. Our announcer is Kim Noble. My thanks to our fellow movie critics, Tom Poe, Lori Lockerbie. And I want to let you know that all of our ratings and our top five lists will be on KCUR.org, so you can check them out there. Up to Date is next with a look at the legal world of comic book superheroes and the job market prospects for 2013. This is Russ Simmons. Enjoy your day.